Moolala is brought to you by the nonprofit credit counseling agency, Credit Canada. If someone close to you is in debt, you might want to help them out financially. You might feel obligated to help them out financially. And in some communities, this is much more widespread than others. Money coach Lynette Kalfanikok says it is not uncommon for Black Americans to assist family members who are in need when it comes to money. It's called the Black Tax, which is not a phrase that I had heard. In a personal essay that Lynette published on Vox, she talks about her own experience and also the racial wealth disparity that exists and that she's experienced firsthand. She is the CEO of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. She joins us today from Houston, Texas. Hello there.
Hi there, Bruce. Thank you for having me. It's a great topic. I'm happy to have this conversation.
It is a great topic, but it's not the topic that I thought. When I saw, I interpreted the phrase Black Tax to mean something different than you defined it in your piece. How do you define it?
So when I talk about the Black Tax, I'm referencing the fact that those of us who are African Americans and who are first in our families to quote unquote succeed at some level often feel a financial pull. And so that level of success might be, I was the first in my family to go to college. I was the first to become a homeowner. I was the first to get a six-figure job. I was the first to achieve a certain amount of savings or net worth. And then when you have that quote unquote success, it's not at all uncommon for family members, you know, siblings, aunts, you know, mom or dad, you know, nephews, nieces, et cetera, who have not frankly achieved the same level of either economic or, you know, kind of social, socioeconomic status, who have not achieved that same level of success, to have needs and to ask you for things. Mm. It might be cash, it might be loans, it might be they want you to co-sign for something. Now, I really wanna make very, very clear that having quote unquote the Black Tax is not something that is exclusive or this phenomena as a whole of the pull of those of us who are first in our families. It's not exclusive to Black families. The term originated in South Africa, and it is exclusive to us when we talk about Black people in our lived experiences. But certainly there are people who are Polish, who are German, who are Colombian, who, you know, from all around the world, who also many of my Asian friends and et cetera, experience the same pull to be called upon to support, to give money, et cetera. It's just that when it happens within the African-American community, we call it the Black Tax. And our economic story here in America, obviously, is very different than other groups.
It's interesting that we're having this conversation today, because literally last night, I lead a financial coaching program here in Canada. And one of our coaches talked about her culture. She said, where I'm from, you are responsible for your immediate family. You are also responsible for the cousins and the aunties and the uncles. And as someone who was born and raised in my family, has been a white family in Canada, that is just not how our family culture works. And you referenced other groups of people who may have come to Canada or come to the US and they're the first in, but there isn't that cultural context. Why do you think that is so relevant and resonant within the Black community, the cultural side of it? And I'm going to get to the racism side of it too, but the cultural side of that.
Well, I think there are a couple of factors at play. First, I don't want to portray all Black people, all African-Americans certainly, as a monolith. Yeah. Because frankly, in my husband's own family, for example, it was not the norm. So he was, you know, pretty much raised an only child. Later, he reconnected with two siblings who were kind of long lost siblings. And his parents and his grandparents, if you asked for money in the family, it was a big no-no. It was, you kind of got your hand slapped there. So it was the family norm was about achievement and success and independence, like doing the right things, managing your money right, and being kind of strong and capable on your own. So this is to say that this is not obviously a universal thing among all Black people. That's the point I want to make. Yeah. But part of the why, I think, is that we do have to look at a number of things from a from a social, cultural, and of course, an economic standpoint, right? So none of us live on an island. None of these things exist on their own. So in many ways, I think some families have a history of either financial dependence or codependence to a certain extent. So it may be that that's the only way that the family survived, right? So you had some families who, you know, whether it was those who were in the South and then one person went, quote unquote, up North, and I'm talking, of course, among African-Americans, say generations and or decades ago, maybe an aunt or an uncle came, you know, from, quote unquote, down South to up North, then came the cousins, then came the siblings. And because they wanted or needed kind of that nucleus of support, that family structure, the economic support, et cetera, you had these relationships that got increasingly financially interwoven. Now, of course, in today's society, you know, we're far flung. I have, you know, two sisters in California. I have two sisters in Georgia. I used to live in New Jersey. I came here to the Houston area in 2019. So we're all over the country. We still provide, you know, love and emotional support and that kind of thing. We're not financially intertwined because we're not either A, all in the same city, or B, living literally under the same roof or in a multi-generational household. But I think that some of those factors actually did play a role in how this has evolved over the years. And then you get to the fact that, frankly, I found, and I just know this as a money coach, in many families, again, not just African-American, obviously all across America, there is a lot of what I call financial dependence and or sometimes financial abuse. Now, don't, you know, fall out of your seat here. Financial abuse happens anytime someone that you know, trust, or love takes economic advantage of you. They might not be intentionally doing it. It may not be like their intent, like, let me try to squeeze something out of you. But they might just know how to push your buttons. Or they might know the right things to say to guilt you or to get you to do something financially for them. And I do think that this plays out, again, in African-American households and elsewhere, where let's say you are the first to have achieved, and then somebody says, I need money for, you know, my mortgage or my rent, or can you help me with this payment, you know, to send my kids to college or whatever. And then if you say no, or if you try to establish barriers or boundaries, some of them, the first question might be, oh, you forgot where you came from. Right. Oh, or you're better than us now. Or, oh, you have a degree, or you make this much money, or you live here. And you know, do you remember when we were younger when I did this for you? So it is sort of familial structure, it's history, it's cultural. There's a lot of factors, not to mention, which I'm sure we're going to get to, just structural inequality and the ways in which there's a wage gap, there's an income gap, you know, there's a wealth gap, and there's greater financial need in many African-American households. So they're reaching out for supports that don't exist elsewhere.
You write about your mom. You are one of five kids. I'm one of five kids, but our upbringings were completely different. And your story and her strength as a single mom raising you, it's both inspiring and also just eye-opening, because I don't think that if that's not your lived experience, that you can kind of put yourself into that world in the way that you so eloquently demonstrated. How does this connect to the topic at hand here? And I say, I want to have you bring the anecdote here. It practically felt like you were leaning through the Zoom screen and saying, Mom, why do you need a sweater? What would you need a sweater for? I'll just cut you the check so you can have heat that exists at a regular level. Give us the essence of that.
Sure. So, you know, over the course of the pandemic, we started doing a lot more FaceTimes, you know, my mother and I, just for me to see her. She lives in Georgia. And I started to notice, like, she's in her house and she's kind of like bundled up. She was wearing sweaters. And as it turned out, yes, she didn't want to have to pay a higher utility bill. And she didn't, you know, she was cold. And like a lot of seniors who are in retirement, who live on a fixed income, et cetera, she was watching her dollars. And I was like, Mom, I'll pay for some of this. But she didn't want to have to ask because she does have a strong sense of independence. And, you know, like a lot of older adults, she doesn't want to have dependency, but she knows that her trajectory and her options and what she experienced were totally different than my generation and my sisters and I, and what we were afforded the opportunity to accomplish professionally, educationally, financially, largely because we stood on her shoulders. Even frankly, both of my parents divorced when I was about 7 years old, but both of my parents really emphasized education. They were like, which college will you be attending? To all of us. It wasn't
not whether you will go, it will be which one.
Which one will you be attending? So we all went to college, you know, and three of my sisters, we got graduate degrees, and the same three of us became business owners. And my dad, you know, again, was the first entrepreneur, frankly, that I ever knew. My dad was a shoeshine man from Harlem. His father was a shoeshine man, and then his father was a shoeshine man. So three generations of Black men who clearly did not have a college education and didn't even have access to a range of financial boosts, let's call them, that their white counterparts, their white friends, colleagues, et cetera, did have. So when you talk about how this all relates, my mother being a single mom, when my family was in New York, and again, I was born in Manhattan, but I was raised in Southern California in Los Angeles, but I didn't move there until I was, you know, 2 years old onward. But in New York, where my parents met and married, my dad had been in the military. You know, guys came back and had the GI Bill. They were able to get home loans, et cetera. You know, you think about a place like Levittown in New York, it's the first place where the middle class in America was really built here with all of these homes and subsidized mortgages and insured government loans. But well, my dad couldn't get that, even though he did his same military service, et cetera, because there was literally discriminating housing back then. You know, it wasn't until, you know, the 60s, the late 60s, where we started having housing laws to ban redlining and discrimination. But even, you know, codes that were written into the law and deeds that said you cannot sell to a Black person. Mm. So my family, they were in New York and then in California. My parents never owned a home. I grew up in 2-bedroom apartments my entire life. And again, 5 girls, picture us being in an apartment, Bruce.
Mom, the 2 bedrooms, but also the 1 bathroom must have been a challenge.
All of that. My mom in 1 bedroom and then 5 girls in the other bedroom with 2 sets of bunk beds. So my sister Cheryl on the top of 1 bunk bed, my sister Debbie on the next one, then my sister Denise, and then me and my sister Hope on the second of the bottom sets of bunk beds. It wasn't until I was in my 20s that I bought my first home after I, you know, went to undergraduate, graduate school, got married, and I lived in Philadelphia at the time. And I bought my first home. Now, fast forward, here we are, you know, I won't say how many years later, but my husband and I, Earl and I, we own 7 properties. You know, we use real estate as a wealth building tool. We have amassed a 7-figure net worth. We bought our older 2 kids their first homes to put them on the pathway to wealth building. So it's definitely a breaking of the cycle, if you will. But I'm very much cognizant of the fact that I'm in the minority. You know, only 45% of African Americans own their own homes versus 75% of white Americans. And that 30 percentage point gap is actually worse than it was 60 years ago when housing discrimination was legal.
We are almost to our time, but I do want to ask you one last question before we go here. Yes. Just connecting back to the Black tax, you've given us a bit of an insight into the multi-generational and systemic barriers that Black Americans, and I'm sure to some extent, or maybe to an equal extent, Black Canadians are dealing with too. What advice do you have to a listener who hears this conversation and has been nodding their head the entire time on how to deal with that in their life in this moment when there are requests that they either can't grant or choose not to grant for whatever reasons. How do they as individuals navigate that for themselves?
So it is a thorny situation to deal with. No doubt it's complex. But I think the central point that I would make is to begin to establish financial boundaries. I actually am a proponent of adults standing on their own two feet and being responsible for themselves, even amid challenging times. Doesn't mean that you can't help. Doesn't mean that you can't support when necessary. But I do think you have to use prudence and to determine, like, how often is this person coming to the well? If you find that they're repeatedly asking you for money, for loans, for cosigning, et cetera, then it's absolutely time to cut the financial apron strings and to start another approach, to talk to them about ways in which they can, within the context of all that they're facing, financially empower themselves through knowledge and education, through tools, through learning how to better manage their finances, et cetera. I don't like to put off on individuals structural things and systemic things that should be solved, mm-hmm. but there are things obviously that each one of us can do within the context of our own lives. And I don't believe in being a financial enabler because honestly, in the long run, it doesn't do anybody any good. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like teach a man to fish rather than constantly feeding him. And that's kind of the approach and the strategy that I would try.
Even better, teach the woman to fish. That's teach even the woman better.
Teach the person to fish.
Lynette, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Lynette Colfani-Cox is CEO of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. She joined us to talk about the Black Tax, as well as many other things connected to the racial wealth disparity that exists in our world today.